Blood flows freely from the wound, and Lincoln's chest suddenly rises and falls as pressure is taken from his brain. Dr. Leal has been a practicing physician for all of 2 months, having just graduated from Bellevue Hospital Medical College. He wears an Army uniform, as befitting a doctor who currently works in the Wounded Officers' Ward at the U.S. Army's General Hospital in nearby Armory Square. The bulk of his medical education took place during the Civil War, so despite his short time as a practicing physician, he has seen more gunshot wounds than most doctors see in a lifetime. Yet he encountered those wounds in hospitals far removed from the battlefield, when the patients were in an advanced stage of recovery. He has never performed the sort of critical life-saving procedures that take place immediately after an injury. But Dr. Leal somehow knows just what to do, and he does it well. Working quickly, Leal straddles Lincoln's chest and begins resuscitating the president, hoping to improve the flow of oxygen to the brain. He shoves 2 fingers down Lincoln's throat and presses down on the back of the tongue, just in case food or drink is clogged in the esophagus. As he does so, 2 other doctors who were in the audience arrive on the scene. Though far more experienced, Army Surgeon Dr. Charles Sabin Taft and Dr. Albert King defer to Dr. Leal. When he asks them to stimulate the blood flow by manipulating Lincoln's arms in an up-and-down, back-and-forth manner, they instantly kneel down and each take an arm. Leal, meantime, presses hard on Lincoln's torso, trying to stimulate his heart. Then, as Leal will one day tell an audience celebrating the 100th anniversary of Lincoln's birth, he performs an act of great and urgent intimacy. I lean forcibly forward, directly over his body, thorax to thorax, face to face, and several times drew in a long breath, then forcibly breathed directly into his mouth and nostrils, which expanded the lungs and improved his respirations. Dr. Leal lies atop Lincoln, his lips locked with Lincoln's, offering what looks to be a lover's kiss. The theater below is a madhouse. Men in the box around him look on, recognizing that Leal is performing a medical procedure, but struck by the awkward pose nonetheless. Dr. Leal doesn't care. Every bit of his energy is poured into accomplishing the impossible task of saving Lincoln. Finally, he knows in his heart that the procedure has worked. He will later recall, "After waiting a moment, I placed my ear over his thorax and found the action of the heart improving. I arose to the erect kneeling position, then watched for a short time, and saw that the president could continue independent breathing, and that instant death would not occur. I then announced my diagnosis and prognosis." But Dr. Leal does not utter the hopeful words the onlookers wish to hear. They have seen the president breathe on his own. They know that his heart is functioning. Clearly, they think the president might survive. Only Dr. Leal has seen the dull look in Lincoln's pupils, a sure sign that his brain is no longer functioning. "His wound is mortal," Dr. Leal announces softly. "It is impossible for him to recover." A soldier vomits. Men remove their caps. Mary Lincoln sits a few feet away, but is in too much shock to comprehend what's just been said. Someone hands Dr. Leal a dram of brandy and water, which he slowly dribbles into Lincoln's mouth. The president's prominent Adam's apple bobs as he swallows. The pandemonium in the theater, meantime, has not diminished. The frenzy and shouting are deafening. No one in the state box speaks as Dr. Leal works on Lincoln, but its list of occupants has grown larger and more absurd. With John Parker, Lincoln's bodyguard, still strangely missing, no one is blocking access to the little room. To one side on the couch, the distraught Mary Lincoln is being comforted by Clara Harris. Major Rathbone drips blood on the carpet, trying to staunch the flow by holding tight to an injured arm. There are 3 doctors, a half dozen soldiers, and a small army of theater patrons who have battled their way into the box. And then, almost absurdly, the actress Laura Keene forces her way into their midst and kneels at Lincoln's side. She begs to be allowed to cradle Lincoln. Dr. Leal, somewhat stunned but knowing it can do no harm, agrees. Keene lifts the president's head into her lap and calmly strokes his face. Before becoming an actress, she worked for a time as a restorer of old paintings, so she is more than familiar with the world of art and sculpture. She knows that this moment is Michelangelo's Pietà come to life, with her as Mary and Lincoln as Christ. Surrounded on all sides by what can only be described as anarchy, Laura Keene nurtures the dying man. The war years have been hard on her. Drink has made her face puffy, and the constant wartime barnstorming has done little to stop her slowly declining popularity. The chestnut-eyed actress with the long auburn hair knows that this moment will put her name in papers around the world. So there is more than a touch of self-indulgence in her actions. But Laura Keene is not maudlin or the slightest bit dramatic, as Abraham Lincoln's blood and brains soak into the lap of her dress. Like everyone else in the state box, she is stunned. Just a few minutes before, the President of the United States had been a vibrant and larger-than-life presence. Now, everything has changed. Chapter 46, Friday, April 14, 1865, 11 p.m. The President of the United States cannot die on a dirty floor. No one knows how much longer he will live, but he must be moved. Dr. King suggests they move him to the White House, where he can pass the final moments of his life in the comfort of his own bed. But Dr. Leal knows better than to attempt a bumpy carriage ride through Washington, particularly through panicked crowds that will necessitate the driver stopping and starting and turning quite suddenly. He will be dead before we get there, Leal says firmly. The young doctor agrees, however, that Lincoln should be resting in a bed, not on the floor. Dr. Taft sends a soldier to scour nearby boarding houses for an empty room. Four other young soldiers are ordered to lift Lincoln back into the rocking chair and carry the president out of the theater. But Dr. Leal overrules Taft. The logistics of carrying a rocking chair containing a man with very long legs borders on the absurd. Just getting down to the lobby involves navigating sharp angles, a narrow corridor, two small doorways, and a flight of stairs. A stretcher would be ideal, but none is available. Leal orders the four soldiers to stop gawking and get to work. They will lock their hands beneath the president and form a sling. Two will lift the torso, while two will carry the legs. They will transport Lincoln head first. Leal will walk backward, cradling Lincoln's head in his hands. Laura Keene steps aside. She can't help but marvel at Lincoln's upper body, still possessing the lean look of the young wrestler renowned for feats of strength. The youthful power and appearance of his chest is in marked contrast to that famously weathered face. The only clue that this great body is actually dying is that his skin is pale and growing more so by the moment. The four soldiers, John Corey, Jabez Griffiths, Bill Sample, and Jacob Soles of the Pennsylvania Light Artillery, now slip their hands under the torso and raise Lincoln to a sitting position. Dr. Leal, with help from the other two physicians, dresses the president in his frock coat and buttons it. "Guards," barks Leal, "clear the passage." As if leading a processional, Laura Keene waits for the body to be lifted. She then marches out of the box, followed by the backward-walking Leal, the four soldiers, and Dr. King, who supports a shoulder, if only so he can remain a part of the action. Through the hallway, out into the dress circle, and down the stairs they travel. Mary Lincoln follows in their wake, stunned and shaky as she walks. Their progress is slow for two reasons. The first is that theatergoers blocked the way, desperate for a peek, desperate to be able to say they saw Lincoln's corpse. The faithful make the sign of the cross and mumble a quiet prayer as Lincoln passes before their very eyes. "Clear the way," Leal barks. Soldiers in the crowd respond, jumping forth to push back the mob. It becomes a wrestling match. Chairs are destroyed. Punches are thrown. Noses are bloody. A Union officer finally draws his sword and threatens to cut down any man standing in Lincoln's path. This manages to quiet the crowd, but only for an instant. The second reason for the dawdling pace is that the bullet hole in Lincoln's head is clotting at an amazing rate. When this happens, Lincoln appears to be in obvious discomfort from an increased pressure against his brain. So despite the anarchy all around him, Dr. Leal orders the processional halted every few feet, then he slips his forefinger into Lincoln's skull to clear the hole, bringing forth even more blood, but taking pressure off the president's brain. They finally reach the lobby, but don't know where to go next. By now, soldiers have found the partition usually used to divide the state box. At 7 feet long and 3 inches thick, it makes a perfect stretcher for Abraham Lincoln. His body is shifted onto the board. Dr. Leal and the other two surgeons decide they will carry Lincoln into Tal Tavol's tavern right next door. A soldier is sent to clear the tavern, but he soon comes back with word that Lincoln will not be allowed inside, and for very good reason. Peter Tal Tavol is a patriot, a man who spent 25 years in the Marine Corps band. Of all the people in the crowd on this frenzy night, he is one of the few who has the foresight to understand the significance of the presidency and how the night's events will one day be viewed. "Don't bring him in here," Taltaville tells the soldier. It shouldn't be said that the President of the United States died in a saloon. but where should they bring him? Leal orders that Lincoln be lifted and carried to the row houses across the street. There is an enormous crowd in front of Ford's. It will be almost impossible to clear a path through their midst, but it's vital that Leal get Lincoln someplace warm and clean immediately. The pine stretcher is lifted, and Lincoln's body is carried out into the cold, wet night, the procession lit by that murky yellow light from the tar torches. Lincoln's carriage, with its magnificent team of black chargers, is parked a few feet away. Then his bodyguards arrive, not John Parker. For the instant he heard that Lincoln was shot, he vanished into the night, continuing his villainy. No, it is the Union Light Guard, otherwise known as the 7th Independent Company of Ohio Volunteer Cavalry, that gallops to the rescue. These are men who have served as Lincoln's bodyguards during his rides around the city and out to the soldiers' home. They raced over from their stables next to the White House when they heard about the shooting. Rather than dismount, they work with other soldiers on the scene to make a double-wide corridor from one side of 10th Street to the other. Leal and the men carrying Lincoln make their way down Ford's granite front steps and onto the muddy road, still not knowing where they will finally be able to bring Lincoln, but glad to be away from the chaos and frenzy of Ford's. Only more chaos awaits them in the street. The violent mob has swelled from dozens to hundreds in mere minutes as people from all around Washington have sprinted to Ford's theater. Many are drunk, all are confused, and no one is in charge. "Bring him in here," a voice shouts above the madness. Henry Safford is a 25-year-old War Department employee. He has toasted the Union victory every night since Monday, and tonight he was so worn out that he stayed in to rest. He was alone in his parlor reading when the streets below him exploded in confusion. When Safford stuck his head out the window to see what was happening, someone shouted the news that Lincoln had been shot. Safford raced downstairs and out into the crowd, but finding it impossible to go further, as everyone acted crazy or mad, he retreated back to the steps of the Federal-style brick row house, in which he rents a room from a German tailor named William Peterson. Safford stood on the porch and watched in amazement as Lincoln's failing body was conveyed out of Ford's. He saw the confusion on Dr. Leal's face as it inched across 10th Street, and witnessed the way Dr. Leal stopped every few feet and poked his finger into Lincoln's skull to keep the blood flowing. He saw Leal lifting his own head and scanning the street front, searching for some place to bring Lincoln. Now Safford wants to help. "Put him in here," he shouts again. Dr. Leal was actually aiming for the house next door, but a soldier had tried and found it locked. So they turned toward Safford. This was done as quickly as the soldier could make a pathway through the crowd, a sketch artist will remember later. Just moments earlier, he had been so enthralled with the happy crowd in front of Ford's that he impulsively grabbed a pad and began drawing. Women with wide skirts and wearing large poke bonnets were as numerous as the men. The scene was so unusual and inspiring. But now, he is sketching a melee and the sad scene of the form of an injured man. He will later say, "I recognize the lengthy form of the president by the flickering light of the torches and one large gas lamp." The delay at the curb and the slow, careful manner in which he was carried across the street gave me ample time to make an accurate sketch. It was the most tragic and impressive scene I have ever witnessed. Dr. Leal and his stretcher bearers carry Lincoln up 9 short, curved steps to the front door of the Peterson house. "Take us to your best room," he orders Safford. And though he is hardly the man to be making that decision, Safford immediately realizes that his own second-floor room will not do. He guides the group down to the spacious room of George and Huldah Francis, but it's locked. Safford leads them deeper into the house to a room that is clearly not Peterson's finest, but that will have to do. He pushes open the door, which features a large glass window covered by a curtain, and sees the room is empty. The room is that of William Clark, a 23-year-old Army clerk who is gone for the night. Clark is fastidious in his cleanliness, so at just under 10 feet wide and 18 feet long, furnished with a 4-poster bed, table, bureau, and chairs, the bedroom is cramped, though a very neat space. But Lincoln is much too big for the bed. Dr. Leal orders that the headboard be broken off, but it won't break. Instead, the president is laid down diagonally on the red, white, and blue bedspread. The lumpy mattress is filled with corn husks. His head points toward the door and his feet toward the wall. Ironically, John Wilkes Booth often rented this very room during the previous summer. In fact, as recently as 3 weeks ago, Booth lolled on the very bed in which Lincoln is now dying. Everyone leaves but the doctors and Mary Lincoln. She stares down at her husband, still wearing his boots, pants, and frock coat. There are two pillows under his head, and that bearded chin rests on his chest. Now and then he sighs involuntarily, giving her hope. "Mrs. Lincoln, I must ask you to leave," Dr. Leal says softly. Mary is like a child, so forlorn that she lacks the will to protest as others make decisions for her. The First Lady steps out of William Clark's rented room into the long, dark hallway. "Live," she pleads to her husband before she leaves. "You must live." Chapter 47, Saturday, April 15th, 1865, Washington, midnight to dawn. Dr. Leal strips Lincoln's body. He, too, marvels at the definition of the muscles on the president's chest, shoulders, and legs. This is clearly the body of a man who has led a vigorous life. Dr. Leal searches the body for signs of another wound, but finds none. The area around Lincoln's eyes and forehead is becoming swollen and black and blue, like a boxer's face after a tough fight. Moving down the long and slender frame, Leal is disturbed to feel that Lincoln's feet are now icy to the touch, which he immediately treats by applying a mustard plaster to every inch of the front of Lincoln's body, from shoulders down to ankles. No drug or medicine in any form was administered to the president, he will later note. But the artificial heat and mustard plaster that I applied warmed his cold body and stimulated his nerves. He then covers the president with a blanket as Dr. Taft begins the process of removing the ball from Lincoln's head. Taft inserts his index finger into the wound and pronounces the ball has penetrated beyond the fingertip. Meantime, Lincoln's pockets are emptied and his belongings carefully cataloged. An Irish linen handkerchief with an embroidered letter A. Money, both Confederate and U.S. Newspaper clippings, an ivory pocket knife, and a pair of gold-rimmed glasses whose broken frame the president had mended with a string. More brandy and water is poured between Lincoln's lips. The Adam's apple once again bobs during the first spoonful, but not at all for the second. With great difficulty, the doctors gently turn Lincoln on his side, so that the excess fluid will run from his mouth and not choke him. Lincoln is battling to stay alive. That's quite clear to each doctor. A normal man would be dead by now. The Surgeon General of the Army, Dr. Joseph Barnes, arrives and takes control of the scene. Barnes is closely followed by future Surgeon General Charles H. Crane. Dr. Leal has been bold and aggressive these past few hours since the shooting. He now explains his course of action in great detail to two of the most powerful and well-regarded physicians in America. Both men agree with Leal's assessment and treatment, much to the young physician's relief. The human brain is the most complex structure in all the world's biology, a humming and whirling center of thought, speech, motor movement, memory, and thousands of other minute functions. It is protected on the outside by the skull, and then by a layer of connective tissue membranes that form a barrier between the hard bone of the cranium and the gelatinous soft tissue of the brain itself. Lincoln's brain, in which a Nelothonian's probe, a long porcelain pencil-like instrument, is now being inserted in hopes of finding the bullet, contains vivid memories of a youth spent on the wild frontier. This brain dazzled with clarity and brilliance during great political debates. It struggled with war and the politics of being president, then devised and executed solutions to the epic problems of the times. It imagined stirring speeches that knit the country together, then made sure that the words, when spoken, were uttered with exactly the right cadence, enunciation, and pitch. It guided those long, slender fingers as they signed the Emancipation Proclamation, giving 4 million slaves their freedom. Inside his brain, Lincoln imagined the notion of one country, one destiny. And this brain is also the reservoir of Lincoln's nightmares, particularly the one in which, 2 weeks earlier, he envisioned his own assassination. Now, thanks to a single round metal ball, no bigger than a marble, Lincoln's brain is finished. He is brain dead. Dr. Leal realizes that he is no longer needed in that cramped bedroom. But he does not leave. Emotion supersedes professional decorum. Leal, like the others, can barely hold back his tears. He has noticed that Lincoln is visibly more comfortable when the wound is unclogged, so he sits next to Lincoln's head and continues his solitary vigil, poking his finger into the blood clot every few minutes, making sure there's not too much pressure on Lincoln's brain. A light rain is falling outside, but the crowd is eager for news and will not leave. In the next room, Secretary of War Stanton has arrived and now takes charge, acting as interim president of the United States. Word of the assassination has brought a crowd of government officials to the Peterson House. The police investigation is beginning to take shape. It is clear that Booth shot Lincoln, and many believe the actor also attacked Seward in his bed. Vice President Andrew Johnson, whose luck held when his assassin backed out, now stands in the next room, summoned after learning of Lincoln's plight. All the while, Dr. Leal maintains his vigil by dim candlelight. The occupants of the bedroom change constantly, with clergymen and officials and family members stepping in for a moment to pay their respects. More than 65 persons will be allowed inside before the night is through. The most frequent presence is Mary Lincoln, who weeps and even falls to her knees by the bedside whenever she's allowed a few moments with her husband. Leal takes care to spread a clean white handkerchief over the bloody pillow whenever she is about to walk in. But the bleeding in Lincoln's head never ceases, and before Mary Lincoln departs, the handkerchief is often covered in blood and brain matter. At 3 a.m., the scene is so grisly that Mary is no longer admitted. The various doctors take turns recording Lincoln's condition. His respiration is shallow and fast, coming 24 to 27 times a minute. His pulse rises to 64 at 5:40 a.m. and hovers at 60 just a few moments later. But by then, Leal can barely feel it. Another doctor makes notes on Lincoln's condition. 6:30, still failing in labored breathing. 6:40, expirations prolonged and groaning, a deep, soft cooing sound at the end of such expiration, audible to bystanders. 6:45, respiration uneasy, choking and grunting, lower jaw relaxed, mouth open, a minute without a breath, face getting dark. 6:59, breathes again a little more at intervals. 7 a.m., still breathing at long pauses, symptoms of immediate dissolution. With the president's death imminent, Mary Lincoln is once again admitted. Dr. Leal stands to make room. She sits in the chair next to Lincoln and then presses her face against her husband's. "Love," she says softly, "speak to me." A loud, unnatural noise in Dr. Leal's description barks up from Lincoln's lungs. The sound is so grotesque that Mary collapses. As she is carried from the room, she steals one last glimpse of her husband. She has known him since he was just a gangly country lawyer, and has shared almost half her life with him. This will be the last time she sees him alive. "I have given my husband to die," she laments, wishing that it could have been her instead. Dr. Leal can't find a pulse. Lincoln's breathing becomes guttural, then ceases altogether before starting again. The room fills with a small army of elected officials, all of whom wish to witness the historic moment of Lincoln's death. Outside, it is dawn, and the crowds have grown even larger, with everyone waiting for a sliver of news. In the bedroom, Robert Lincoln sobs loudly, unable to control his grief. He stands at the head of the bed and looks down at his father. Dr. Barnes sits in the chair, his finger on Lincoln's carotid artery, seeking a pulse. Dr. Leal has moved to the other side of the bed and wedged himself against the wall. He once again holds Lincoln's hand, simultaneously using his index finger to feel for a pulse on Lincoln's wrist. There is no death rattle. Lincoln draws his last breath at 7:21. His heart beats for another 15 seconds, then stops altogether at 10 seconds past 7:22 a.m. More than 20 men are packed inside the bedroom. Nobody says a word for 5 long minutes. Dr. Barnes reaches into his vest pocket for a pair of silver coins, which he places over Lincoln's eyes, one of which is now completely black and blue. Dr. Leal, meantime, folds the president's arms across his chest and carefully smooths his hair. He barely hears Secretary Stanton rumble, "Now he belongs to the ages." Part 4, The Chase. Chapter 48, Saturday, April 15th, 1865, Maryland countryside, early morning. John Wilkes Booth and David Harrell, the most wanted men in the United States of America, have successfully fled into the Maryland countryside. They met up at the rendezvous spot in the dead of night. With no sign that Azaro or Powell managed to escape Washington, Booth and Harrell pushed on with their flight, galloping their horses south toward Virginia. However, Booth's leg injury is so severe, and their horses so tired, that they were forced to find a place to rest. They are now hiding in the house of the eminent physician and Confederate sympathizer, Dr. Samuel Mutt. Somewhere in Washington, George Azaro and Lewis Powell are still on the loose. The authorities don't know any of that yet. No numbers, no identities, and no motives. But even before Lincoln breathed his last, they began the intricate process of unraveling the mystery of his death. Investigators stumble upon Azaro's trail first, after failing to carry out the assassination of Vice President Johnson. The carriage painter spent the night wandering aimlessly around Washington, getting thoroughly drunk in a number of bars and making sure to dispose of the knife he was supposed to use to kill the vice president. Other than plotting against the president of the United States, he has committed no crime. Azaro has a reputation for being dim, but he is canny enough to know that once he threw his knife into the gutter, the only obvious piece of evidence connecting him with the conspiracy was being seen publicly on Booth's horse. It might take days for authorities to make that connection. If he maintains a low profile and keeps his wits about him, there is every chance that he can get out of Washington and get on with a normal life. Azaro is all too aware that returning to his room at the Kirkwood house would be a very stupid idea. So just before 3 a.m., he checks into the Pennsylvania House Hotel, where he's assigned a double room. His roommate at the time, when Azaro needs to be as far away from the long arm of the law as possible, is a police lieutenant named W.R. Keem. The two men know each other from Azaro's previous days at the Pennsylvania house. They lie on their backs in the darkness and have a short conversation before falling asleep. Keem is stunned by the slaying of Lincoln. As drunk as he is, Azaro does an artful job of feigning sadness, saying the whole Lincoln assassination is a terrible tragedy. Lieutenant Keem never suspects a thing. But events are already conspiring against Azaro. Even as he sleeps off his long, hard night of drinking and walking, detectives sent to protect Andrew Johnson are combing through Azaro's belongings at Kirkwood House. A desk clerk remembers seeing a villainous-looking individual registered in room 126. Azaro took the only room key with him when he fled, so detectives have to break down the door to investigate. Quickly canvassing the empty room, they come up with the first solid lead about Lincoln's murder. In the breast pocket of a dark coat hanging on a wall peg, they discover a ledger from the Ontario Bank in Montreal. The name written inside the cover is that of John Wilkes Booth, whom scores of eyewitnesses have already identified as Lincoln's killer. The book confirms the connection between Azaro and Booth. A quick rifling of the bed produces a loaded revolver under the pillow and a Bowie knife hidden beneath the covers. And that's just the beginning. Room 126 soon becomes a treasure trove of evidence. A map of southern states, pistol rounds, a handkerchief embroidered with the name of Booth's mother, and much more. Investigators now have two suspects, Booth and Azaro. Warrants are issued for their arrests. At the same time, an anonymous tip leads investigators to raid Mary Surratt's boarding house on H Street in the dead of the night. Nothing is found, but Surratt's behavior is suspicious enough that detectives decide to keep an eye on her and the house. A similar anonymous tip leads police to room 228 at the National Hotel, Booth's room, which is quickly ripped apart. Booth has left behind an abundance of clues, among them a business card bearing the name J. Harrison Surratt, and a letter from former conspirator Samuel Arnold that implicates Michael O'Loughlin. More and more, it is becoming obvious that John Wilkes Booth did not act alone. A few blocks away, detectives question Secretary of State Seward's household staff, which adds two more nameless individuals to the list, the man who attacked Stewart and his accomplice, who was seen waiting outside. This brings the number of conspirators to six, Booth, Azaro, O'Loughlin, Arnold, and Seward's two unknown attackers. John Surratt becomes a suspect because police are watching his mother. The detectives, thrilled at their brisk progress, are sure they will arrest each and every member of the conspiracy within a matter of days. Meanwhile, Washington is in a state of shock. Flags are flown at half-mast. Vice President Andrew Johnson is sworn in as the 17th President of the United States. Secretary of State Seward is not dead, as is widely rumored, but he is very badly injured. He will be in a coma through Saturday, but will awaken on Easter Sunday. Gazing out the window, he will see the War Department's flags at half-mast and immediately know what has happened. The president is dead, Seward will sigh. When his nurse insists that this is not the case, Seward will hold his ground. If he had been alive, he would be the first to call on me, he will say. But he has not been here, nor has he sent to know how I am. And there's a flag at half-mast. Then he will turn his head from the window, tears down his cheeks, their salt mingling with the blood of his still fresh wounds. But now it is still Saturday morning. Black crepe replaces the red, white, and blue bunting on government buildings. Liquor outlets are shut down so that angry Washingtonians don't find yet another excuse to begin drinking and perhaps in their drunken anger start looting. Multiracial crowds gather in front of the Peterson House, grateful to be merely in the presence of the hollow ground where Lincoln died. Just across the street, Ford's Theater has instantly gone from a Washington cultural hub to a pariah. The good fortune of having Lincoln attend Our American Cousin will soon put the theater out of business. The government will decree that the building may never again be used as a place of public amusement. The cast of Our American Cousin is so afraid of being attacked by angry mobs that the actors and actresses lock themselves inside the theater after the shooting. One of their own, Harry Hawk, has already been taken into police custody for sharing the same stage as Booth. Throughout the nation, as the news spreads, Abraham Lincoln's worst fears are being realized. Outraged Northerners mourn his loss and openly rant about revenge, while Southerners rejoice in the death of the tyrannical man who wouldn't give them the freedom to form their own nation. The Civil War, so close to being finally over, now seems on the verge of erupting once again. Believing that catching Lincoln's killer will help quell the unrest, Secretary of War Stanton spends Saturday expanding the search, making the hunt for Lincoln's killers the biggest criminal dragnet in American history. Soldiers, cavalry, and every imaginable form of law enforcement throughout the northern states are called off every other task in order to devote all their energies to finding John Wilkes Booth and his band of killers. In the same manner that Grant attempted to besiege Petersburg by throwing a noose around the city, Stanton hopes to throw a giant rope around the northeast, then slowly cinch the knot tighter until he squeezes out the killers. He also sends a telegram to New York City, recalling Lafayette Baker, his former spymaster and chief of security. The strange connection between Stanton and Baker now becomes even stronger. Why does Stanton call for Baker, of all people? As all of this is going on, George Azarod wakes up at dawn on Saturday morning, still drunk after 2 hours of sleep. He is somehow oblivious to the fact that people might be looking for him, nor does he have any idea that the man who assaulted Secretary Seward, Lewis Powell, is also stuck in Washington, hiding out in a cemetery after being thrown from his horse. Azarod knows he must get out of Washington, but first he needs money to fund his escape. He has no plan, and is under no delusion that he will find a way to meet up with John Wilkes Booth, nor does he want to. Azarod leaves the Pennsylvania House and walks across the city to nearby Georgetown, where he makes the unusual gesture of calling on an old girlfriend. He tells her he's going away for a while, and if she might somehow want to come along. And then, as mysteriously as he appeared, Azarod leaves the home of Lucinda Mertz and pawns his revolver for $10 at a nearby store. He uses the money to buy a stagecoach ticket into Maryland, taking public transportation at a time when all common sense cries out for a more inconspicuous means of escape. But now fate is smiling upon George Azarod. Nobody stops the stagecoach as it rolls out of Washington and into Maryland. Even when the stage is halted and searched by Union soldiers miles outside the Capitol, nobody suspects that the simple-witted Azarod is capable of being resourceful enough to take part in the conspiracy. In fact, Azarod is so unassuming that the sergeant in charge of the soldiers actually shares a few glasses of cider with the conspirator. In this way, George Azarod stumbles deeper and deeper into the countryside on his way, he believes, to safety and freedom. Chapter 49, Saturday, April 15th, 1865, Maryland countryside, noon. John Wilkes Booth is miserable. Flat on his back on a bed in the country home of Confederate sympathizer Samuel Mudd, Booth screams in pain as the 31-year-old doctor cuts off his boot and gently presses his fingers into the grossly swollen ankle. As if shattering his fibula while leaping onto the stage wasn't bad enough, Booth's horse threw him during his 30-mile midnight ride through Maryland, hurling his body onto a rock. Booth is sore, hungover, exhausted, and experiencing a new and nagging anxiety. that of the hunted. After the assassination, Booth and David Harrell rode hard all night, stopping only at a small tavern owned by Mary Surratt to pick up some Spencer rifles she'd hidden for them. Harrell was glib, boasting to the Confederate proprietor that he'd killed the president. But he also had his wits about him, buying a bottle of whiskey so Booth could enjoy a nip or two to dull the pain. Then they rode on, 10 more hard miles on tree-lined country roads. For Booth, every mile more painful than the last. It was the actor's leg that made them detour to Mudd's house. Otherwise, they would have reached the Potomac River by sunrise. With any luck, they might have even stolen a boat and made the crossing into Virginia immediately. Still, they're close, very close. By choosing to take shelter at Mudd's rather than stay on the main road south to the Potomac, they have veered off the fastest possible route. But Mudd's 500-acre estate is just north of Bryantown, south and east of Washington, and fully two-thirds of the way to the Potomac River. Booth's pants and jacket are now splattered with mud. His handsome face, so beloved by women everywhere, is unshaven and sallow. But more than anything else, John Wilkes Booth is helpless. Almost overnight, he has become a shell of himself, as if assassinating Lincoln has robbed him of the fire in his belly, and the pain of his shattered leg has transformed him from daredevil to coward. He is now completely dependent upon David Harrell to lead their escape into the South. At a time when Booth needs all his wiles and resources to complete the second half of the perfect assassination, he is too distraught and in too much agony to think straight. Dr. Mudd says he's going to splint the leg. Booth lies back and lets him, despite the knowledge that this means he will no longer be able to slip his foot into a stirrup. Now he must ride one-legged, half on and half off his horse, if he can ride at all. Mudd finishes splinting the leg, then leaves Booth alone to get some rest. The actor is in an upstairs room, so if anyone comes looking, he won't be found right away. He wraps a shawl around his neck and face to conceal his identity, and he has plans to shave his mustache. But otherwise, he does absolutely nothing to facilitate his escape. The pain is simply too great. It will take a miracle for Booth to travel even 1 mile farther. Booth rolls over and closes his eyes, then falls into a deep sleep, sure that he is being hunted, but completely unaware that more than 1,000 men on horseback are within a few miles of his location, and that Lafayette Baker is now on the case. Chapter 50, Saturday, Sunday, April 15th, 16th, 1865, New York City morning. Lafayette Baker is in his room at New York's Astor House Hotel when he hears that Lincoln has been shot. The disgraced spy who was sent away from Washington for tapping Secretary Stanton's telegraph lines is not surprised. His first thought, as always, is of finding a way to spin the tragedy for his own personal gain. Baker loves glory and money. He understands in an instant that the man who finds Lincoln's killer will know unparalleled wealth and fame. Baker longs to be that man. It's noon on Saturday when a telegram arrives from Stanton summoning him to come here immediately and find the murderer of our president. If Baker were an ordinary man and not prone to weaving elaborate myths about himself, that telegram would be a very straightforward call to battle. But Baker is so fond of half-truths and deception that it's impossible to know if he's traveling to Washington as a sort of super sleuth hand-picked by Stanton to find Lincoln's killers, or if he is traveling to Washington to find and kill Booth before the actor can detail Secretary Stanton's role in the conspiracy. Whatever the case, at a time when Baker could have been anywhere in the world, Stanton knew exactly where to find the fired spy so that he could be summoned to the Capitol. Lafayette Baker takes the overnight train to Washington, arriving at dawn. The city is in chaos, and he will later describe the looks on the people's faces as inexpressible, bewildering horror and grief. Baker travels immediately to the War Department, where he meets with Stanton. "They have killed the president. You must go to work. My whole dependence is upon you," the secretary tells him. The entire detective forces of New York, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and Boston have traveled to Washington and are devoting their considerable professional talents to finding the killers. But Stanton has just given Baker carte blanche to move in and take over the entire investigation. One of Baker's specialties is playing the part of the double agent. Even though there is evidence that Baker and John Wilkes Booth are somehow connected to each other through the 178.5 Water Street, New York address, Baker claims that he knows nothing about the case or about the suspects. His first act is to post a reward for $30,000, leading to the arrest and conviction of Lincoln's killers. He also has photographs of John Surratt, David Herold, and John Wilkes Booth plastered all over Washington. Chapter 51, Saturday, Sunday, April 15, 16, 1865, Maryland countryside. David Herold needs a buggy. It's the most obvious solution to John Wilkes Booth's plight. With a buggy, they can travel quickly and in relative comfort. He asked Dr. Mudd to loan them his, but the doctor is reluctant. Secretly harboring fugitives is one thing, but allowing the two most wanted men in America to ride through southern Maryland in his personal carriage would surely implicate Mudd and his wife in the conspiracy. Their hanging, for that is surely the fate awaiting any Lincoln conspirator, would leave their four young children orphans. Instead, Mudd suggests that they ride into Bryantown and pick up some supplies and check on the latest news. With Booth still passed out upstairs, Harold agrees to the journey. But as they draw closer and closer to the small town, something in Harold's gut tells him not to take the risk. A stranger like him will be too easily remembered by such a tight-knit community. He is riding Booth's bay now because it's too spirited for the actor to control with his broken leg. Harold lets Mudd go on without him, then wheels the mare back to the doctor's home. Good thing. The United States Cavalry now has Bryantown surrounded. They're not only questioning all its citizens, they're not letting anyone leave either. This is the sort of savvy, intuitive thinking that separates David Herold from the other members of Booth's conspiracy. Azarode is dim, Powell is a thug, and Booth is emotional. But the 22-year-old Herold, recruited to the conspiracy for his knowledge of Washington's back streets, is intelligent and resourceful. He was educated at Georgetown College, the finest such institution in the city. He is also an avid hunter, which gives him a full complement of outdoor skills that Booth now requires to escape. The additional ability to improvise in dangerous situations and an instinctive sixth sense about tracking, or in this case, being tracked. But now Harold is just as exhausted as Booth. He didn't endure the same extreme adrenaline spike last night, if only because he didn't kill anyone. But he experienced a definite and sustained rush as he galloped over the Navy Yard Bridge, then along the dangerous darkened roads of Maryland. He's had time to think and to plan, and he knows that constant forward movement is the key to their survival. Otherwise, Harold has no doubt that the cavalry will be on their trail in no time. Clearly, they cannot stay at Dr. Mudd's any longer. Just before dusk, Harold rouses Booth and helps him down the stairs and up into the saddle. Harold guides them south through the countryside, aiming for the Zakiya Swamp with its quicksand bogs and dense strands of old-growth hardwoods. The few trails that exist are almost impossible to see in the dark, and the pair are soon lost and frustrated. They turn back toward Mudd's farm, but remain out of sight, plotting their next move. The next 12 hours bring an enduring awareness that they are neither safe nor welcome anywhere. Easter Sunday dawns hard and bleak. Harold and Booth are camped in a strand of pines a quarter mile off the main road. A cold front is racing across Maryland, and they shiver in the damp, swampy air, just a few short miles from the final obstacle to their escape into Virginia, the Potomac River. Booth isn't wearing a boot on his injured leg, and his foot and ankle are in pain and quite cold from walking on swampy ground in the thin shoes he took from Mudd. Yet Harold doesn't dare make a fire. Beside him, Booth is curled up in the fetal position, head resting on one hand. Each man clutches his revolver as a stiff wind bends the towering pines. The last sympathizer they visited, the wealthy owner of 40 slaves in this still lawless region, promised to send a man to ferry them across to safety. The rescue signal will be a soft whistle, a pause, and then another soft whistle. So now they wait. Hour after brutally cold hour, they wonder who will deliver them from this hell. Booth says little, except to cry out in pain or mutter something about not being taken alive. He still has some fight in him. Now and then they hear the jangle of bridles from the nearby road. And all the while, a gnawing little voice in Harold's gut tells him that they have been betrayed, that the whistle, when it comes, will be their only warning before United States cavalry confirm their position and ride in with guns blazing. Late Sunday afternoon, they hear the first whistle, then a second. Confederate sympathizer Thomas Jones calls out to them in a low voice, announcing that he is walking into their camp. Chapter 52, Monday, April 17th, 1865, Maryland Swamps. There is nothing dashing or heroic about the man who has come to save the lives of Booth and Harrell. Thomas Jones is a broken man, a 44-year-old smuggler who has done time in prison, outlived his wife, and lost his home. He now earns his living by transporting everyone from secret agents to diplomats across the Potomac River to the south. On average, he makes the crossing three times a night. He is so skilled that northern newspapers secretly enlisted his help to get their product into the south during the war. A favorite technique employed by the silver-haired and low-key Jones is to begin the first crossing just before dusk, when the angle of the sun makes it impossible for sentries on the opposite shore to see small craft on the water. It is a brazen and brilliant tactic. Clearly, if any man can get Booth and Harrell to safety, it is Thomas Jones. On his first visit to the campsite, he merely wanted to get a look at the men he would be helping to see if they were mentally and physically capable of enduring what might be a very long wait until it is safe to cross. His second visit comes one day later. It is also the second day in the pine forest for Booth and Harrell. They once again hear the whistle from the trees. Booth is even worse today. The pain in his leg so severe that he doesn't do much more than whimper. Harrell stands, carbine pointed, toward the sound of approaching footsteps, until Jones finally appears in their thicket, his pockets overflowing with ham, butter, bread, and a flask of coffee. In his hands, he holds the one thing Booth wants to see more than any other, newspapers. Cavalry are combing the countryside, he cautions the killers, and he reminds them to be patient. It might take several days before things die down. No matter how cold it gets, no matter how extreme the conditions, they must be prepared to hunker down in the woods until the coast is clear. As soon as it is, he will let them know. Booth argues that their lives are in danger and that they can't stay here any longer. But the thunder of hoofbeats from the nearby road stops him short. It's Union cavalry and far too close for comfort. "You see, my friend," Jones whispers, "you must wait." He tells them to kill the horses, lest their whinnying give the killers away. Prior to the assassination, Booth would have continued to argue and then done as he pleased. But now he quietly gives in. "I leave it all with you," he says to Jones. Jones departs. His visits are uplifting to Booth and Harrell, a welcome break from the monotony of sitting still for hours and hours out in the open. They don't even dare build a shelter for fear the noise will attract unwelcome attention. Jones doesn't just bring food and newspapers. He also offers hope, his cool confidence suggesting that it will all be well, just so long as they are patient. With a sigh, Booth turns his attention to the newspapers. He reads about the extent of the search, but his melancholy soon turns to rage as he learns that his monumental actions are not being applauded. Far from it. He is being labeled a scoundrel and a coward for shooting Lincoln in the back. Washington newspapers assail him as war's ultimate villain, and note that any kindly feeling toward the South or its sympathizers has disappeared, thanks to his actions. Booth's achievement is described in the Richmond papers as the most deplorable calamity which has ever befallen the people of the United States. And finally, the nation's most staunchly anti-Lincoln paper, the National Intelligencer, is now crying out that Lincoln was a true American hero. The very newspaper that the actor had once hoped would print the letter explaining his actions is instead portraying him as an abomination. Booth, overcome with despair, sets the papers aside. As is his new habit, he regales Harrell with a monologue on the killings, regrets, desires, and misunderstandings. Then he takes out his diary and begins keeping a journal of their time in the wilderness. In it, he writes his reflections on killing Lincoln, just to make sure that his point of view is properly recorded for posterity. "I struck boldly and not as the papers say. I walked with a firm step through 1,000 of his friends. Was stopped but pushed on," Booth writes. "I can never repent it, though we hated to kill. Our country owed all her troubles to him, and God simply made men the instrument of his punishment." Booth writes and rants and writes some more. Then he sleeps. Then he awakens and writes some more. There's nothing else to do with his time. So it is with the world's two most wanted men, bored to tears in a Maryland swamp. Chapter 53, Monday, April 17th, 1865, Mary Surratt's boarding house, nighttime. Mary Surratt has been a suspect since the night Lincoln was shot. an anonymous tipster alerted Washington police that the boarding house on 8th Street was the hub of the conspiracy. Detectives questioned her at 2 in the morning, even as Lincoln lay dying. The widow was forthcoming about the fact that John Wilkes Booth had paid her a visit just 12 hours earlier, and that her son John had last been in Washington 2 weeks earlier. When a thorough search of the house turned up nothing, the police left, no arrests was made. Now they're back. One of her boarders, Louis Weichman, has volunteered volumes of information to the authorities about the comings and goings of Booth and the conspirators at Mary Surratt's boarding house. This eyewitness information has confirmed not only that Booth is at the heart of the plan, but that Mary Surratt is complicit. It is well past midnight when police surround the house. She answers a knock at the door, thinking it's a friend. "Is this Mrs. Surratt's house?" asks a detective. "Yes." "Are you Mrs. Surratt?" "I am the widow of John H. Surratt." "And the mother of John H. Surratt, Jr.?" "Yes." "Madam, I have come to arrest you." Three policemen step inside. Mary's 22-year-old daughter, Anna, is also taken into custody. Just before they are led outside, Mary asks permission to kneel in prayer. "She is a devout Catholic and prays the blessing of God upon me as I do in all my actions." The house is quiet. Her words echo through the half-lighted rooms as the detectives awkwardly wait for Mary to finish praying and rise to her feet. Then there's another knock on the door. When the detectives open it, they are shocked by the sight of a 6-foot-2 man with a pickaxe slung over his shoulder, wearing a shirt sleeve on his head like a stocking cap. His boots are covered with mud, and he is unshaven. As he steps inside, they see that there appears to be blood on his sleeves. The detectives quickly close the door behind him. Louis Powell, starved and famished after 3 days of sleeping in the woods, instantly realizes he has made a grave error. "I guess I am mistaken," he quickly tells the detectives, turning to leave. The police send Mary and Anna Surratt out the door, where carriages wait to take them to jail. Then they focus their attention on the tall stranger with the pickaxe. Powell gives his name as Louis Payne and fabricates an elaborate story saying that he has come to Mary Surratt's at her behest in order to dig a ditch for her in the morning. The police press him, asking Powell's address and place of employment. When he can't answer in a satisfactory manner, they arrest him. At the police station, he is strip-searched, and an unlikely collection of items, including cash, a compass, a pocket knife, and a newspaper clipping of Lincoln's second inaugural address, are found in his pockets. So far, all the evidence points to Payne's involvement in the assassination. His height and rugged build clearly matched the description of Secretary Seward's attacker. The police summon the young black servant, who had given the description to the station. William Bell has been interrogated a number of times since the attack, so, as he is called back to the station once again, his attitude is weary. The late hour does not help. However, when a lineup of potential suspects is paraded into the room before him, Bell becomes instantly euphoric. He marches right up to Powell and presses his finger against the lips of the man who mocked him, insulted him with a racial slur, and very nearly killed his employer and several members of the family and staff. "He is the man," Bell proclaims. This is the last moment in Louis Powell's life when he is able to move his arms freely and walk without hearing the clank of chains. Manacles are placed on his wrists. A ball and chain will be attached to each ankle in the days to come. The unyielding iron cutting deeply into his flesh every time he takes a step. A canvas hood will soon be placed over his head, with only a small hole through which he can draw breath and eat. And yet, there is much worse to come for Louis Powell. Chapter 54, Tuesday, April 18th, 1865, Maryland Swamps, both day and night. The military sweep through southern Maryland is ongoing and intense. Searches of towns and homes have turned up nothing, and it is clear that the time has come to scour more daunting terrain for Booth and Harold. A combined force of 700 Illinois cavalry, 600 members of the 22nd Colored Troops, and 100 men from the 16th New York Cavalry Regiment now enter the wilderness of Maryland's vast swamps. "No human being inhabits this malarious extent," is how one journalist describes the region. "Even a hunted murderer would shrink from hiding there. Serpents and slimy lizards are the only living denizens. Here, the soldiers prepared to seek for the president's assassins, and no search of the kind has ever been so thorough and patient." The method of searching the swamps is simple yet arduous. First, the troops assemble on the edge of the bogs, with names like Allen's Creek, Scrub Swamp, and Atoll Swamp. Standing at loose attention in the shade of a thick forest of beech, dogwood, and gum trees. Then they formed two lines and marched straight forward from one side to the other. As absurd as it seems to the soldiers, marching headlong into cold, mucky water, there is no other way of locating Booth and Harrell. Incredibly, 87 of these brave men will drown in their painstaking week-long search for the killers. The soldiers were only a few paces apart, the journalist reports, and in steady order they took to the ground as it came, now plunging to their armpits in foul water, now hopelessly submerged in slime, now attacked by legions of wood ticks, now attempting some unfaithful log or greenishly solid morass, and plunging to the tip of the skull in poisonous stagnation. The tree boughs rent their uniforms. They came out upon dry land, many of them without a rag of garment, scratched and gnashed and spent, repugnant to themselves and disgusting to those who saw them. The soldiers detain anyone with anti-union leanings. For many of the arrested, their only crime is either looking or behaving suspiciously. Taking them into custody is the best possible way to ensure that no suspect is overlooked. Hundreds of these suspects will soon fill Washington jails. But not a single trace of Booth or Harrell can be found anywhere. Back in Washington, Lafayette Baker follows their progress. Since arriving in the Capitol 2 days earlier, Baker has distanced himself from the other investigators, taking the usual detective measures till then neglected, of offering the reward, circulating photos of the suspects, and sending out a small army of hand-picked detectives to scour the countryside. But Baker is hampered by the lack of railroads and telegraph lines through the rough and lawless countryside. There is, however, a telegraph line at Point Lookout, a former Union prisoner of war camp at the mouth of the Potomac River. To keep himself informed of all activities in the area, Baker dispatches a telegraph operator by steamship to that location and orders him to tap into the existing line. Now, safe in the knowledge that he has established the broadest possible dragnet, Lafayette Baker waits for that telegraph line to sing. Chapter 55, Tuesday, April 18th, 1865, Maryland Countryside, Afternoon. The moment Dr. Samuel Mudd has been dreading for 2 days comes while he is in the fields working his crops. The cavalry unit galloping up to his driveway is not there by accident. There are at least 24 riders, not including his cousin George. It was George to whom Mudd confided that two strangers had spent the night of Lincoln's assassination in his home. They spoke after Easter services, even as Booth and Harrell was still very much in the vicinity. Mudd took pains to state that his life was in danger should these two men ever come back. The story was a cover, intended to make it look as if he had no knowledge of the strangers' identities. It was Mudd's hope that George would act as an intermediary, alerting the police to the fact that his good Samaritan cousin might just have accidentally aided the men who killed Lincoln. George, however, is a devoted Union sympathizer. Instead of the police, George has brought the cavalry, with their rifles, sabers, and no-nonsense military bearing. The riders dismount. Lieutenant Alexander Lovett is in charge and quickly begins a line of questioning to determine exactly who and what Samuel Mudd saw that night. Mudd is not a brave man and is quickly rattled.